I'm just a little afraid.
This is a pretty simple one. It's straightforward. I'll just go right in and then right out, and it'll be over before you even know. First, I'm going to sterilize the area with the alcohol pad here.
I'm not going to look.
No problem.
All over?
All over.
This time of year, people all over the metro, including our own Sylvia Maria Gross, line up for flu shots. And yeah, getting a shot may be scary, but it's a modern-day luxury, one not available in 1918, when the so-called Spanish influenza killed more than 2,000 people in the Kansas City area. In the wake of swirling fears about the possible arrival of diseases like Ebola and actual outbreaks of pertussis and measles in the state of Kansas, Central Standard looks back on a historic flu pandemic. The death toll in Kansas City outpaced international casualty rates, and some say our public health policy was to blame. For more on that, we're joined by Susan Sykes Berry. She works at UMKC's Health Sciences Library. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
As a graduate student, you wrote a 143-page thesis on this very subject. The title of your thesis was Politics and Pandemic in 1918 Kansas City. How did the spread of a historic disease here in Kansas City capture your attention?
Well, I'm also a nurse, and so I've always been interested in medical history. And when you're a graduate student, you're supposed to be looking around for something to write on. And I got interested in the Spanish flu simply because there was so little about it.
Why do you think there was so little about it?
Well, there's a lot of theories on that. Probably it was just because of the war. The war took precedent over everything.
And captured most of the historic exploration of that time period.
Right, right.
Well, put the impact of this disease on Kansas City in a broader context for me. Just how bad was it here?
Well, Kansas City had one of the worst excess death rates in the country. Nothing worked here. The public health measures didn't work. Of course, doctors nowhere had anything to treat it with. But Kansas City kind of stands out. In fact, they've done studies from the NIH that have said when they look back on it, Kansas City kind of really screwed it up.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit more, but where did the disease come from, to the best of people's knowledge? They call it the Spanish flu, but I've read nothing indicating that this flu came from Spain.
Yeah, it was probably just because Spain didn't have censorship. Everybody else was in the war, and all their news was censored, and Spain wasn't part of the war, so there was no censorship there. So when the news started coming out, people just started calling it the Spanish flu because that's where the news was coming from.
Oh, so it was this flu, once it spread everywhere, that's where the news was actually making it public.
Right.
Interesting. Well, we're also joined this morning by Dr. James Fishback, an infectious disease pathologist at KU Medical Center. Hi, James. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
What can you tell us about people's knowledge and understanding in 1918 and 1919 when it came to the spread of viral infections like this deadly flu virus?
Well, they didn't know much. I mean, there were people at the federal level that understood viruses that had been working on it, but public health was more or less non-existent. And, of course, we had no antibiotics. Antibiotics didn't come about till World War II, really.
Would antibiotics have made a difference in this? It's my understanding that that would only impact the spread of a bacterial infection.
Well, that's true, but with influenza, it damages the lining of the bronchial tree and allows entry for bacteria. So people think that about half of the deaths from the great flu epidemic or pandemic were due to bacteria like Streptococcus pneumoniae and Haemophilus influenza.
So, a secondary infection.
It's a secondary infection. And the other half were just due to the virus itself.
What were the prevalent ideas of the time, and I'd like you both to weigh in on this, about how to contain the spread of a disease like this?
People knew that diseases spread. Germ theory was known, and people wore masks and things like that, and they tried to quarantine people. But the doctors had nothing to treat it with. They could suppress cough with codeine and heroin, interestingly.
Wow.
And they could give aspirin and oxygen, but that was about it.
That's fascinating. Where did people – so they were quarantining people and treating them with codeine and heroin. Where were these quarantines located?
Well, the quarantine was on the city. They would put a public health order out and quarantine the city. But the problem was that the quarantines were full of holes because every military activity was exempt. So, you know, even though the city's quarantined, the military stuff is still going on. Well, that's not a very effective quarantine.
Well, you asked earlier where the flu came from. There's an interesting theory that it came from Haskell County, yeah. Kansas. And it was a soldier that came to Camp Funston at Fort Riley, and it spread at Fort Riley. And from Fort Riley, of course, the soldiers were sent all over the world. So there are many people that think that it should be called the Kansas flu because these soldiers disseminated it to Europe.
How long has this theory been out there? I mean, did people at the time recognize the Kansas?
No, they really didn't.
When did that come to light?
Probably Barry's book, The Great Influenza, was the first that really mentioned it. But other historians have looked at it. And they're actually I looked at the Kansas newspapers, and there was a soldier who came home on a 4-day leave, went back to Camp Funston, and, you know, the camp got sick about 2 weeks later, and they had over 1,000 people ill. And, you know, the troop trains are running through, and so it's a possibility.
How did the survival rates for this influenza outbreak compare with survival rates for other infectious diseases at the time?
Well, they were pretty high. I know the estimates are all over the place. The United States was about the only place that kept really good records. They estimate between 600,000 and 800,000 people died in the United States. And then the estimates for worldwide deaths are between 20 and 100 million. So pretty wide variation. So the death rate is kind of hard to calculate, but they estimated up to 5% of the world population died. So it was probably exceeded 50%, I suppose.
5% of the world population?
More than the Black Plague.
Wow. So the flu is still dangerous, and people do die from it even in 2014. But the number of deaths we're looking at in 1918, that's just something else. That would be like, at least as far as the local rates are concerned, if 2 out of every 100 people I know were to die of the flu in one season, which is almost unimaginable to me. Was there something about this strain of the influenza virus that made it so lethal?
Well, yes. I mean, it was thought to have come through pigs, swine flu, in other words. And it did seem to be more lethal than other strains of influenza A.
There were waves of this flu. So the very first wave was at the first of the year, so like February and March. And that wave was milder, and people got sick, and it was very contagious. Lots of people got sick, but not too many people died. But then the second wave that started in September, October, that was quite deadly. And it was deadly for people who should have been the healthiest.
What do you mean by that?
Well, people who were, you know, in the prime of their life, the young people, 20 to 40, and they died at a higher rate than the young and the elderly, which is normally who gets the flu and dies from
it. Why do you suspect that would be?
Well, they think it's because their immune systems were kind of overreacted to, because they have a good immune system, they overreacted to the virus and kind of put out too much of the helpful antibodies and sort of drowned in their own excess secretions.
Wow.
Pneumonia was really, it was a horrible disease. I mean, people would turn blue. They had no idea at first that it was the flu. They thought it was typhoid or cholera or malaria. But it really was just a vicious form of the flu.
Yeah, pathologically, the type of lung infection was completely different than what had been seen before. It's what we call interstitial pneumonia, which is in between the air sacs. And nowadays, we'd call it ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome. And so the flu pandemic was really what led to the first characterization of that now very common syndrome that we see in ICUs all the time. And it has a very high mortality. Today, the mortality is probably 10 to 20%.
What do we do for it now?
Respirators.
Well, you were saying a moment ago that the spread was higher among people in a certain age range, and that would be also the age range that would have been fighting in a war. And you've mentioned a relationship between the war and this outbreak. Do you think that has something to do with who was contracting this illness?
Well, certainly if you're out and fighting a war, you're exposed to everything. So I'm sure that did have a great deal to do with it. But I want to be clear, it's not that they caught it more, it's just that they died more from it. So in other words, almost everybody caught it, but it was only people in that healthy range that normally doesn't die from things that were dying of this particular.
Right. The people that die in the United States now, and there were about 36,000 deaths from flu last year. Most of them are elderly, and so they always tell elderly people to get your flu vaccine. Last year we had a strain that was virtually identical to the 1918 mm-hmm. strain, H1N1, that came through Kansas City and killed quite a number of young people, and we had several cases at KU.
Nowadays, we have universities across the nation running graduate programs in public health. Every city has a health department. Public health infrastructure is a big deal. And even if it can't prevent or contain crises, I mean, as we just heard, crises still occur today. But that effort is in place. Was there a public health infrastructure in 1918, 1919?
Not really.
Yeah.
<That's, laughs> Not to speak of.
That's pretty much the answer.
So just no.
Kansas City did have a hospital and health board. They had around 300 physicians in the city. There was about 19 nurses. With those kind of numbers, and then plus of those 300 doctors that they had listed, many of them were at war. I mean, they weren't here. And so that was another problem is, you know, you've got doctors, but they're off at war.
There was a U.S. Public Health Service, and they actually asked for doctors to volunteer. Mm-hmm. You were supposed to send a telegraph to the United States Public Health Service volunteering. But as Sue said, there weren't any physicians left, really. Yeah. A lot of them were being used for the war.
At the end of the epidemic in Kansas City, they do telegraph the Surgeon General. And Rupert Blue was the Surgeon General of the United States at the time, and he sent a doctor to Kansas City to try and help us. Wasn't very effective.
Sue, you made the argument in your graduate thesis that the politics of Kansas City had a lot to do with the degree of impact this so-called Spanish influenza had on our city's population nearly a century ago. Can you explain that?
Well, we had boss politics. Tom Pendergast was running the city, and he was sharing control at this point in time with Joe Shannon. Now, they were both Democrats, but they were rivals. And so every city department was split 50-50. So Shannon got to appoint half of them, and Pendergast got to appoint half of them.
And did they interact with each other, or were they kind of siloed?
Well, they're rivals. I mean, you know, my boss is Tom Pendergast, and your boss is Joe Shannon, and we don't get along.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we return, we'll take your questions about the influenza pandemic of 1918 and the role politics played in the profound death toll here in Kansas City. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Susan Sykes Barry and James Fishbeck. We're exploring the science and politics of the historic influenza pandemic of 1918. The death rate here in Kansas City was above and beyond what was seen internationally. Do you have questions about this moment in our city's history or about the role of public health infrastructure in preventing and containing contagious diseases? Call 816-235-2888. That number again is 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. So as we were going into the break, we were talking about these politics, how city politics shaped public health response and maybe contributed to the death rates here. And Sue, I wonder if you had anything you wanted to add on that note before we move the conversation forward.
Well, it's real possible to see the difference if you look at Kansas City, Kansas, because you got to remember we've got a state line, and so there's not a whole lot of cooperation. But what you can look at is you can look at the policies that were happening in Kansas City, Kansas compared to Kansas City, Missouri. And basically the Kansas City, Kansas response was very measured, very cooperative.
What did that mean at that time? What was a measured 1918 response?
Well, the city pitched in. Public health was not funded. So you had to, if you needed an extra hospital, you'd have to open up a school or a church or some sort of building. And so someone would have to pay for that. Well, other city departments would step up and contribute money to do this. In Kansas City, that didn't happen. What happened was that...
Kansas City, Missouri.
What happened here was that the Chamber of Commerce, led by B.A. Parsons, he kind of managed our response because the city was doing nothing.
That's so incredible to think of a city doing nothing when a pandemic is already having this kind of effect. Nowadays, when just the thought that maybe something could come here has policies being established, protocols being determined. Maybe they'll work, maybe they won't, but people anticipate these things before they even arrive, let alone once they're already here.
Was that a question?
Oh, I'm just wondering if when you think about the difference there, how do you think about that in relation to the actual spread of disease and the death rates that we saw historically?
Well, I am not a public policy expert, but certainly control of flow of sick patients and using quarantine is a very important part of public health.
Quarantine is very unfashionable right now.
Sure.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, how have attitudes toward quarantine changed and to what do you attribute that change?
Well, quarantine, I mean, TB sanatoriums, for example, were built to get people with TB off the streets and into places where they would get better. And one of the big treatments was lots of fresh air. So Kansas was a popular place for that. And they usually got six meals a day. So nutrition was also another part of it. And one of the more famous sanatoriums were those run by Dr. Post and Dr. Kellogg in Battle Creek, Michigan. And we still have Post... what is it called? Post flakes or something like
the
that.
The cornflakes.
Post cornflakes and then Kellogg's cornflakes. And those were both come up with independently in Battle Creek by these two competing sanatoriums. So it worked with TB, and it's worked with a lot of other diseases too. So I think it's a viable way to do things.
Well, the Army Motor School was here in Kansas City. And they instituted a 21-day quarantine. And 21 days was what they felt was an ideal time period for quarantines for this flu. And the Army Motor School had a much, much, much lower death rate than the city of Kansas City. Kansas City tried to institute quarantines, but it wasn't all their fault. there's a war going on. And you know, men are moving across the country and the trains are coming through. And lots of you know, construction is going on and building. And if you shut down the material and the men, then the war effort is harmed. So you don't want to be responsible for doing that. And yet if you don't shut it down, it's not a very effective quarantine.
Sue, I have a question for you. That this new strain of flu that came from, supposedly came from Haskell County. Do you think the proximity of Camp Funston to Kansas City had anything to do with the number of cases here? And did it affect mortality at all?
Well, that's a really interesting question that I don't know the answer for. I would guess no, simply because there were Army bases everywhere. All the big cities had them. So my guess would be no, but it's just a guess.
Because that would be true for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is interesting there was a difference in mortality between Kansas and Missouri.
Yes.
Which plays into my prejudices. As a
No. I'm a Missouri fan.
I'm sorry.
Well, speaking of Kansas versus Missouri, we've got a caller from Lawrence. Let's talk to Steve in Lawrence. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I'm an amateur genealogist, so I heard some things about the flu that I just wanted to pass on very quickly. Three short anecdotes. My father was a policeman, or grandfather was a policeman in Kansas City, got his job through the Pendergast. But during the war, he took a leave of absence to go to Pennsylvania, and he worked as a supervisor in a plant that was making aircraft for the Army in 1918. And my grandmother told me when I asked about that time in the family's life, they had three young children, they'd all moved up there. My grandmother told me that men would report to my grandfather that they were sick and they needed to go home. They didn't feel good. The next morning, a member of their family would come to the plant and report that they had died, that it happened that quickly. The second anecdote was just the same thing that your guests were talking about earlier, that it seemed like it particularly targeted young, strong farmers, especially, and soldiers. My wife's grandfather lived near Cameron, Missouri, and he was in his early 30s, a farmer, young and in his prime, and he died of the flu. And, of course, it changed the family's life. His widow had two small children. She had to move away. She had to find a new living situation and remarried. And of course, it changed everything about the family's history from that time on. The third story was a friend's genealogy that I was doing. He had an aunt who was married, lived in Kansas City. They had a five-year-old child who died of the flu. And a few years later, the child's father committed suicide. So I think there were lots of repercussions of the flu for those who were left.
Lots of reverberations, even just within among the community of people you know and their own personal family histories.
Yeah, and definitely changed the course of families' lives from that point on. So I just wanted to pass those on, and I'm enjoying this discussion. Thank you so much for your guests, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, well, Steve, thanks for calling.
Those were great stories, and those are the kind of stories I would find when I was doing this research.
Where did you find your stories? Where did you do your
mostly
research?
Mostly the newspaper was the – because, you know, people didn't keep things, and especially when you have a pandemic, it was very common to burn – the clothes, the bedding, everything, because they didn't really understand that it was caused by a germ. In Chicago, the public health department allowed a huge Liberty Loan parade to go on, but they told all the marchers to go home afterwards, take off their clothes, take a nice warm bath, and take plenty of laxatives, and that would keep you safe.
How did that work?
I don't know. It didn't, obviously.
You know, it's interesting. He mentioned genealogy. My mother passed away last year and
sorry to hear that.
Gave me all this genealogy information. And on her side of the family, the Kinchlow side of the family, there was one of the younger brothers went to France to fight the war and died there of the flu. Yeah. So I was reading about how it sort of devastated the family. He was the baby of the family. And so it's interesting. I think it probably affected everyone.
It seems like if we were all to look into our own genealogies, there's a good chance we'd find some flu there. Do you think that years from now when people are doing their genealogy, there are similar diseases that will appear in a lot of family histories and a lot of stories?
I think so. HIV, for sure.
Do you think that that's the most comparable thing to understanding this influenza?
Well, not really, because it's not spread the same way. But it, as far as social impact, I think it certainly is.
Let's hear from Craig in Prairie Village. He called 816-235-2888. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. I had the pleasure of having immigrant grandparents on my dad's side from Lithuania and Eastern Europe. When they arrived in the early 1900s, they were unmarried and children. But after being married in 1913, they had my father in March of 16. And in summer of 17, my grandmother's mother felt that something was very wrong when people in the neighborhood were going to the hospital or to go get health care and were not coming home. And my grandmother related that it reminded her mother of a Russian flu epidemic or pandemic that had taken place in the late 1880s, early 1890s, just before my grandmother was born. And my grandparents picked up my father, moved to Chicago, and my grandmother related that she felt healthcare in Chicago was much better. And then, with no aspersions cast on Chicago, she couldn't wait to get back to Kansas City, and they moved back here in the summer of 1919, and my uncle was born in the fall of 1919. But they saw this coming, and it was very interesting that she related as how this was one of the really great stories of her life, that she saw this coming. People were not getting better in Kansas City, and she did not stick around to find out why so many people were dying here. She just moved to Chicago.
So families taking matters into their own hands and trying to, in some way, outrun the spread of this virus. Can you talk? Was that common? Do you know?
I think it would depend on your social class. If you have the money to be able to travel, then I'm sure many, many rich people were, you know, moving to their country homes and getting out of the city and all that kind of stuff. But if you don't have money, it's almost impossible to do those things.
That does bring up the issue of class. And also he's mentioning immigration of, mm-hmm. of different communities, immigrant communities and otherwise. Yeah. Did this affect people on a level playing field?
No. There was a infamous area of Kansas City called the McClure Flats. And it was 17th to 18th and Grand to, I can't remember the other street, Walnut maybe. But it was a huge slum. I mean, there were 7-8 families living per dwelling. And I call it a dwelling because it really wasn't a home. And the city health department, they tried to shut it down. They tried for almost 30 years to shut this place down and just raise it. But it wasn't until many, many, many years later that they got that done. And there was a huge outbreak in that area of town.
During the smallpox epidemic of 1898, yes. There seems to have been a widely held belief that white people weren't as susceptible to infection as minority communities. At least that's what I've read. Were ideas like that still prevalent by the time this influenza pandemic came along 20 years later?
Yeah, they were. You know, Kansas City was racially divided. We didn't have segregation. I mean, we didn't have integration. There were separate facilities for blacks, separate hospitals for blacks. And it did seem like, and I'm going to say this, but it's a tentative conclusion, that perhaps blacks did not get the disease quite as much as whites did. And I don't think that's really been studied. Part of the problem I had was finding statistics for blacks. those records are not around. So,
well, there's actually a lot of scientific evidence that diseases affect different ethnic groups in different ways. And tuberculosis is perhaps the most famous. The Warsaw Ghetto, that European Jews tend to do better with tuberculosis than Africans and American Indians. And even with HIV, Caucasians have a mutation in one of their genes that allows more people in the Caucasian population to fight off HIV infections than in the African-American population. So there are genetic differences between ethnicities, and they are affected differently. And, of course, you've got access to health, which is another completely different issue that has a huge effect on disease.
How do – this is sort of a philosophical question, but when there are differences in how different groups actually biologically relate to disease, and then there are perceptions that we have of each other that might be stereotypes, might be positive stereotypes or negative, but how does the reality of this difference interact with perception of difference in a broader context?
Oh, boy, that's a sociology question. Sue, you want to answer that one?
Well – that's a tough question. I think for the Spanish flu, it probably didn't affect it very much, because when such a huge event happens, I think the city did do its best to try and keep the access to healthcare open, but there weren't enough hospitals. There weren't enough doctors. There were definitely not enough nurses.
Did people recognize those as problems?
Yes, yes. They were constantly – in fact, that was one of the things that was so interesting about Kansas City, Missouri – or Kansas City, Kansas, sorry. They deputized ministers. They got together 40 ministers, and they deputized them as nurses and would send them around to help take care of people in their homes. Because it wasn't common to go to the hospital. It was – home care was most common.
Let's talk to Kate in Kansas City. Hi, Kate. Welcome to Central Standard, Kate.
Hello.
Hello.
What do you have to share with us?
Well, I come from a family who doesn't really talk about things that much. And I just found out a few years ago my dad is almost 91 years old. And I always knew, they always said that his sister, my Aunt Thelma, was adopted. But I just never knew until my dad told me recently that the reason she was adopted is because when the pandemic of 1918, whatever it was, his parents were best friends with her parents, and they had a family of four, and everyone died of the flu except this little girl. And so they adopted her.
I wonder how common it was for people to be, for children to be orphaned by this. When you talk about the age range of who most typically died of the disease, it would be people who would be in the prime of early parenthood.
It was quite common. There were stories in the paper about, the parents have both died and there's four children left in the house all alone and there's no one to take care of them and someone just stumbles across them. It was very common for the parents to be gone and the children to be left. There were a lot of orphans.
Sue, James, can you stay with me through one more break?
Sure.
Sure.
Central Standard will return shortly. Don't go away. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm going to have today's guests for this discussion about the influenza pandemic of 1918 reintroduce themselves.
Sue Sykes-Barry.
Jim Fishback.
And you can still get in on the discussion. Call 816-235-2888 to ask these expert guests your questions about historic disease outbreaks and what we can learn from them. Now, I do want to revisit, since James, you are an infectious disease pathologist. For those of us for whom high school science is a way back in the past. Can you refresh my memory about how exactly viral infections spread and what we know about treating them today?
Sure. It, like everything, it depends. HIV, for example, is spread through bodily fluids, and we've all heard about that now since the epidemic started in the early 80s. And that's the same way Ebola is spread, by body fluids. So you have to have exposure to blood or other body fluids, and you have to get it in your eye or on your mucous membranes or a break in your skin.
So bodily fluid comes in contact with a mucous membrane.
Right.
There are, I've heard just socially, a lot of people hearing that information and feeling skeptical of it because it seems like the numbers are so high that they just can't fathom that it really isn't traveling, that it's not airborne, that it's not being transmitted in these other ways.
Well, it's often sexually transmitted, and that's a really great way to spread infection. In fact, if you look at the Ebola epidemic in Africa right now, there's been a little over 4,000 deaths. In the same time period, there's been over 600,000 deaths due to HIV/AIDS. So, you know, Ebola sort of pales in comparison. I would also
add, perspective.
Yeah, I'd also add there's been over 200,000 deaths from hunger during that same time period. So we don't have a very good perspective on Ebola in the United States, I don't think.
Dr. Fishbeck, in Africa, there is currently an outbreak of Ebola, while in the United States, we have a couple of incidents and maybe something that's more akin to a scare. What's the difference between a scare and an outbreak? Where would you put like a...
Well, an outbreak would be transmission, and we can calculate what the transmission is very easily by tracking contacts. And so far, the only transmission that has occurred has been the one index case in Dallas, and two nurses got infected. That hasn't happened in any other hospital. So it's going to take a while to figure this out, but something happened in Dallas, and I don't think the virus had anything to do with it.
Do we communicate about disease differently today than we did in 1918?
Oh, yes. In 1918, medicine, there was still the four theories of disease. There was the miasmas, where it was caused by bad air. The germ theory had appeared, but there was also a chemical theory of disease where zymes caused it. And you could find doctors who believed any of those. And so there was not a lot of scientific knowledge about what was going on.
At what point in the spread of infection back in 1918 did major newspapers take note?
They really started noticing the flu in October. October was kind of when it broke out in a big way.
And it originated, what, February, March?
Is yeah, that what February I recall? And March was the first wave.
Well, let's hear from some of our callers again. We've got Rick in South Kansas City on the line. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is very simple. Given the mobility of the world population today and the way we interact with people, under worst-case scenarios like the pandemic of 1918, what would your experts feel the exposure is compared to 1918's loss of life and damage, et cetera?
So with differences in how much we travel and interact on a global scale, what would you say to Rick?
Well, I presume he's sort of asking about Ebola, but you have to remember the transmission of influenza A is completely different from Ebola. As explained, Ebola and HIV are spread through body fluids and mucous membrane contact. Whereas influenza is spread by aerosols. So if you sneeze out all these particles and you'll quickly fill a room with them, and almost everybody would get infected. Like people on an airplane would get the flu or a cold very easily, whereas Ebola would be almost impossible to transmit on a plane, although you can imagine scenarios where it might happen, but they're pretty out there.
Well, and the other part of that, too, is even though we do have many more ways to travel, in 1918, that war was going on, and people from Haskell, Kansas, were ending up in, you know, Paris, France. So there was
people weren't traveling as much for pleasure, maybe.
Right,
but.
Right. But there was still a lot of travel going on, and travel that we hadn't seen on such a big scale before.
And also the travel was different in that when men went to Europe, it was often in the hold of a ship.
Yes.
And so you were in very, very close contact. So if you had somebody that had the flu, almost everybody on that ship was going to get it.
Right.
You can hear from this caller that it's hard to think about this without the present day concerns kind of entering people's minds. What can we learn from the influenza pandemic of 1918 and our local handling of that crisis?
Well, I think we have a much better health department today. At least it's not quite so political. I know that we have a much better health care system in that the hospitals are well aware of this problem. I guess it comes down to the basics of if you're sick, stay home. You know, don't expose other people if you're ill.
Good, solid, conventional wisdom holds true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this Ebola thing in Dallas is certainly concerning. And I've been thinking about it the last couple of weeks. I mean, how did this happen and what does it really mean? And during the 80s, we all, people in the healthcare professions, became aware of HIV/AIDS and barrier precautions that they keep talking about on TV now. And we all became very familiar with it. And I thought, God, how could they not know how to do that in Dallas? And I think maybe the answer is HIV is really not a huge medical problem in the United States anymore. With AZT and all the heart highly active antiretroviral therapy, we just don't see the kind of AIDS patients that we used to see in the early to mid 80s in Kansas City.
So we forget our lessons.
Forgotten our lessons, I think.
Well, and that's interesting because the pandemic we've been talking about today has been called America's forgotten pandemic. Did we forget it, and when did we remember it?
Well, that's a tough question because it's called the forgotten pandemic because there's so little written about it. The records are incredibly hard to find. That's why I relied so much on the newspaper. It was forgotten. My opinion is it was forgotten because of the war. The war just overshadowed everything, and it was such a huge killer of young men, and it altered the course of the world.
It sounds like in 1999, there was a book that came out called Flu, the Great
Yes.
Influenza Pandemic of 1918 and the Search for the Virus that Caused It. Would you say it's the, and you've got a copy there. I didn't even notice
Yes.
that. What was it about the late 90s that caused maybe a resurgence of interest in this, a return to searching for that question?
You know that one.
Well, you say I know. I don't know what I'm thinking that I'm supposed to think.
Okay.
Can you explain it?
I will explain. They found the virus at the Army Medical Archive, and they were able to recreate the virus because they went and found patients who'd been frozen in permafrost, and Jeffrey Taubenberger from the Army Hospital, he was able to go out and recreate this virus. So that's when it kind of reappeared again because
Oh, okay.
They were able to, they basically created it again.
What has remembering it allowed us to do or allowed us to learn?
Well, certainly don't let politics get in the way of your health department.
Yes, I think we have a lot of education to do of politicians. I think there should be a rule if you haven't studied infectious disease most of your life, you should just shut up.
and listen to an expert who has studied infectious disease.
Well, let's get one more caller in before this time is up. Deborah in Kansas City, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, this is Deborah. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick comment and a question. When you were talking about family history and related to the flu, my great-grandmother and grandfather came here in the late 1880s from England, and they had four children born here, and they had seven altogether. And my grandfather's story to my mother was when he was a little child, and I've looked up some of the records, and it would have been about 1894, that either three or four of his siblings died of the flu within months, and that he told her about running up to the hospital door and banging on the door, wanting them to let his brothers and sisters back out. And the other, my question was, then again in 1918, that's when my mother was born, she told me that she was in gestation in my grandmother, and they both got the flu at that time, and that they both then survived it, but then they both died of Parkinson's, mm-hmm. which when my grandmother in 1960, people, I guess, still knew about that, and they knew it was a sequel of the flu, but my mother... 12 or so years ago, they didn't know that anymore. So
wow.
I just wanted to ask you about that.
That's a really great question. There is a connection between the flu pandemic and Parkinsonism, and it's called von Economo's disease. And not a lot of people know about it.
No, I'm looking at you funny right now.
Well, we used to teach it in medical school, but most of the people with von Economo's disease are dead now. And medical students don't like to hear about diseases that only dead people have. So we've stopped teaching that. But, you know, it was an interesting illness, and it taught us a lot about Parkinsonism, really.
So, but that is interesting to me that when something has passed and when tons of people have died of something and there is a connection between that illness and other diseases maybe that aren't gone, that we just stop teaching about that. We just stop being interested.
Well, and if you're around medical students, you know, they're taught an incredible amount of facts, maybe too many, in my opinion. And so when one begins to cull down the curriculum to get to a point where it can actually be mastered, you have to leave some things out. And unfortunately, von Economo's disease was one of them. However, it was taught to me.
Was von Economo's, did I say that right?
Economo, sure.
Is that related to this specific flu or to flus in general?
To that specific flu. Probably something about the antigens that were in that particular virus cross-reacted with some antigens in the brain that in the area that causes Parkinsonism.
Well, and there was also they called it a sleeping sickness, and that's related to the von Economo's idea. There was a lot of people who, you know, would basically just fall asleep, and doctors had no idea what that was until they started asking, you know, did you have the flu?
So there were reverberations of mm-hmm. this influenza pandemic much beyond 1918, 1919,
yes.
It sounds like.
Yes.
There certainly were.
It sounds like, I mean, would this be, do you think, an important topic to discuss today, even in the absence of this current Ebola scare?
I think it's always important to know your history. Now, I'm prejudiced because I'm a historian, but if you don't know the past, you're just condemned to repeat it. And so I think it's always good to know.
Well, I'm a pathologist, and we like to know everything. So I think it's important, but it's just the way it is.
That is all the time we have for today's conversation, but it's been so great talking to you both. We've been talking about the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, and I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining me today. Susan Sykes-Barry of UMKC's Health Sciences Library, thank you.
Thank you. It's been great fun.
And James Fishback of KU Med, I so appreciate your taking the time today.
Sure.
To listen back to this show or any past conversations you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Go ahead and sign up for a podcast of our show while you're there. tomorrow as the Nelson Atkins calls a town hall meeting to discuss its proposal for a new cultural district, Central Standard will open up a discussion about the growing number of arts districts in our city. What's the relationship between them? Join that conversation tomorrow. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date, coming right up next.